This is the second in our series on Dies Domini, the Day of the Lord, the apostolic letter of Pope John Paul II, trying to encourage us to realize how important keeping the Lord's Day holy in order that the Lord's Day can keep us holy and whole and wholesome. My guest today is Ron Eldred, who's professor at John Paul II Catholic High in history, church, world history, and United States history, and also teaches a religion at our Catholic High. Welcome, Ron. And on our last session, we talked about many of the statistics that indicated not only United States seems to be doing better than other countries, as you indicated. In Mass attendance, Sunday or Saturday night Mass attendance, keeping holy the Lord's Day. And a lot of this seemed to be because of a loss of belief in the real presence. And you talked about several significant surveys that had shown that this has been a real problem since Vatican Council II, 62 to 65, and the after the confusion that set in for so many people after that. So if there's anything you want to say to summarize that, we want to go now to why did this, what's the cultural influences that seem to bring about this loss of faith, and then also occurred, brought about a loss of regular attendance to keep holy the Lord's Day?
Well, in our first session, you made reference to Dies Domini, an apostolic letter written by John Paul II toward the end of his life, the Lord's Day, and had to do with keeping the Lord's Day holy. In the first chapter, he deals with cultural and sociological reasons for this. He doesn't go into much detail, and we're probably going to go in a little more detail than he did, but because he wanted to get on to other things, which we'll also share with our listening audience soon in some subsequent sessions. But I think everyone has his list of culprits when it comes to what is the causes of this decline. And but I think the causes can be grouped under two headings, cultural and sociological. And by culture, I mean the way of life of a people. That's how they usually define culture. It's the way of life of a people, which includes material cultural artifacts, material things like this desk right here, or this picture sitting over here on this table, or a glass or whatever.
Well, how about like movies and radio and television?
Yes, it includes material and non-material, and of course those things have both the material and non-material aspects to it. It also includes the religions that make up that a society has. It includes the ideologies, the ideal structure, the ideas that are a part of the system. And we're more going to be more interested in ideas and how ideas affect the way we behave in the next, at least this session.
And these ideas, we would say, normally are taught or propagated by the media.
Yes.
Schooling, sure. Media, education, the whole environment.
Sure.
Okay. Well, what do you think are some of the influences then, these ideas in the Western world, of which we are the main leader, I suppose?
Well, I thought about this quite a bit before I came up with the list. I had originally around a dozen or so groups of ideas, but finally whittled it down to four or five that I think are probably most dominant. And one of them, I think, is skepticism. Another would be rationalism. Another would be materialism. Another one would be relativism. And finally, hedonism. Now, we're not going to go into the philosophical approaches to this, because that is can be a very complicated subject and would take far more time than we'd have to go into it here. But we'll sort of look at it from a layperson's point of view as much as we possibly can.
All right. Let's start then with the first, skepticism.
Well, everybody knows skeptical, being skeptical of something, and so skepticism is is associated with being skeptical.
I tend not to believe anything.
Yes.
Because I'm always questioning.
Yes.
Which is not a bad thing, but
it gets to be
a bit extreme.
We shouldn't be gullible, and accept anything without some proof or evidence that it's true. That's including our own religion as far as that's concerned. But basically, skepticism is the view that humans cannot achieve complete or perfect knowledge of anything, especially in religious or moral matters. Except for a few hard scientific facts, the skeptic tells us that we can't know anything outside of our minds. That the only thing we could know, of course, is what's in our minds. The ideas and the thoughts that are in our minds, that's all that we can really know. That's the only thing we could know with any degree of certainty. And even that's doubtful. I mean, even what's in our minds is doubtful, because we can be mistaken, of course, a lot of times with what's in our minds. The consequence of this is that we can't know anything with certainty, because there is no objective truth or reality that exists outside of us, or if there is, we can't know it. And when applied to morality, since we can't know anything with certainty, morality is considered entirely a matter of individual preference or opinion. There are no fixed and eternal values. And as we will soon see, skepticism leads to other ideologies such as rationalism and relativism, because all values are considered relative to time and place and circumstance and situation, relevance, context, consequence, or some other such notion. The true skeptic is a chronic doubter. There's
okay.
Nothing wrong, as you said a while ago, with a healthy, methodic doubt. But as I said in response to that, we shouldn't be gullible. We shouldn't just accept anything without evidence, without proof. But when sufficient proof has been given regarding some matter, whether it be religious or whatever, or dealing with morality, I think we're obligated to give assent to it. We're obligated to agree to it. The church would tell us that.
So you're saying that skepticism, I become a skeptic in a bad sense when I question everything and say, well, there's nothing we can be certain of. We're all just guessing to the best we can. I heard a comment about that one time, that we can be a skeptic intellectually, about everything, except if the guy gave me the right change. And then we're saying, hey, there's $5 missing here, and there is objective truth.
Even the skeptic, when it comes down to dealing in day-to-day life, becomes a realist. He becomes one who believes in an objective reality. It's like, I think it was Samuel Johnson once said, he was a lexicographer, a person who compiled dictionaries and things like that. Back in the 18th century, a man by the name of Boswell wrote his biography. And I think Johnson once said something to the effect, he was talking to a skeptic, and he said something to the effect that, going over and kicking a stone real hard, and then of course it causes pain, and that's a reality. That stone really is there. It's not some figment of your imagination.
Okay.
When you kick the stone and it hurts, then that's enough to tell you right there that that's reality.
Okay.
That there really is something there outside
right.
of your mind.
There is objective, reality. Things are real. So intellectually, I think, that I always heard in seminary that we're quoting some philosopher, but I can't remember who it was, but he said, study of philosophy leads to skepticism, but depth in philosophy leads back to reality.
Sure.
Be careful that a little, what's the old saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Okay, well, let's go on. What is rationalism? I don't see a whole lot of difference between rationalism and skepticism.
Well, rationalism comes from a Latin word, means belonging to reason. And In philosophy, it means a theory that holds that reason alone, unaided by experience, can arrive at basic truth regarding the world. In other words, you don't need any kind of experience or anything outside of yourself, you can just reason everything from inside of your mind.
So it would admit there is truth, objective reality outside, but I attain it just by my reason alone.
Yes.
Okay.
It's ironic that rationalism gets its name, its main start from a man by the name of René Descartes, who lived in the 17th century France. He formulated his philosophy, what's called methodic doubt, to counter the skepticism of his own day. But he was a very devout Catholic.
Wow, I sure didn't know that. Thank you for helping my education.
Descartes originally had developed his philosophy of methodic doubt not for the ordinary person, but for intellectuals of his time who were becoming skeptics. And
that was actually the counter skepticism. He was talking against skepticism.
But in a way, he kind of opened the door to a methodical or systematic way of becoming a skeptic, unfortunately.
Okay. All right, so what about his famous saying that everybody quotes?
The Latin.
Cogito, yeah, ergo sum.
Yes.
I think, therefore I am.
Yes. That's the only reality that you can know with any degree of certainty, is I think. Therefore I am, the ideas that you have, that's the only thing you can know with any certainty. Anything outside of your mind you can't know with any degree of certainty, mainly because the senses are imperfect. The blind man, for example, will have one conception of reality. The deaf person will have another conception of reality. Those are extreme cases, of course, of defects, you know, and senses, but your senses are always going to, everything, as St. Thomas Aquinas told us, everything comes through the senses, basically, if it isn't infused, if the Holy Spirit doesn't infuse it into our soul.
So Thomas was for the sense knowledge.
Yes, for the sense knowledge. Okay. Everything comes through the senses. I said, if it isn't infused.
Sure.
By the Holy Spirit. All knowledge. And the senses being what they are, they're imperfect for many different ways. Okay. And not only that, on top of that, we're already conditioned by ideas that are in our mind that we already have, and they are going to determine to some extent how we're going to see everything. It's a very difficult process of knowing what really is outside of our mind and what really is the truth, and we have to work it real hard at knowing. And the church has developed through its theology and its philosophy over the last 2,000 years a very systematic way of ascertaining the truth, and so that we can develop a degree of certitude. A degree of certainty that these things that we find in the Creed are actually true.
I can be sure that there's a tree out there. I can be sure that God is out there in a somewhat different way.
Sure.
But things are real and not just in our mind.
Right.
Okay.
And of course there were other philosophers that carried that to much more extremes. When you go in later into the 18th century and then into the 19th century, if you get into people like Immanuel Kant, for example, and Hegel and philosophers of that sort. But like I said, we decided we wouldn't get into those kind of things in our discussion.
So we're trying to focus on rationalism, and you're saying that René Descartes, who I didn't know was a very good Catholic and who had taught the Queen her faith, he tried to counteract skepticism by this whole new approach he had.
Cogito ergo sum.
Okay.
I think, therefore I am. He believed in the doctrine of innate ideas, a person is just born with certain ideas or has infused into their souls at birth or at conception ideas, and then one deduces all truths from these innate ideas. The ideas, in other words, the raw material, so to speak, of ideas doesn't come from outside through the senses into our mind.
As St. Thomas would say,
that our ideas begin, they're placed there at our birth.
Okay.
They're infused there by maybe the Holy Spirit or whatever, but nonetheless, at the moment of our conception, we get these innate ideas. And then we use those innate ideas to draw conclusions through deductive reasoning about everything that we think is outside of our minds.
So really, Descartes was another explosion in the philosophical world that questioned people's ability to know the truth.
Yes.
And reality. Okay. Well, anything else you want to say about that?
I might say the opposite of rationalism is empiricism. And this is an approach that utilizes the senses and experimentation with which to verify knowledge. A lot of times we think of the scientific method as being an empirical method.
Okay.
Empiricism has to do with using the senses.
Okay.
And, scientific instruments are nothing more than extensions of our senses.
Okay. Telescope.
Telescope is a lets us see into the macro world that we can't see with our naked eye.
Okay.
Microscopes lets us into the micro world that we can't see.
And many people would say, I only believe what I can scientifically behold.
Yes.
Through special instruments, a telescope or a microscope. I can't see God in a telescope, and I can't find him in a microscope. So.
A pure empiricist, that's what they would say.
Okay.
And there's another philosophy that we didn't get into, positivism. That's the only positive method there is the empirical method, that which you can see and taste and touch and feel.
Okay.
But just because you can't taste and touch and feel something doesn't mean it isn't true, that it doesn't exist.
Sure.
And certainly when you get into the realm of religion, you're talking about things that, lots of times you can't always see them.
Certainly can't see love.
Right. Or justice or truth or beauty in the abstract or things of that sort.
Sure.
We can only see particular instances of beautiful things.
Okay.
Or truthful things or just acts or whatever.
All right, you want to go on to materialism?
Yes. Materialism is a philosophic system that denies the existence of any other kind of substance other than that which is made up of matter, such as spirit, for example. That's the opposite of material, spirit, material.
So there isn't anything but material.
There's nothing but material, no spiritual world.
All right.
It claims that all phenomena of the universe can and must be explained by matter and the forces or energies inherent in and intrinsically dependent upon matter. And from a practical point of view, I think it's pretty simple. Materialism means that it's an excessive desire for material goods, for material things, the acquisition of things. So materialism has its philosophical aspect that there's no reality other than that which is material. There's no reality in any spiritual
world. Of course,
now
that was the great belief of the communists.
Oh, sure, sure.
That there is no God, there's no spiritual, there's no soul, and so we've got to make a paradise here on earth.
Sure.
Because there's only material.
But in our in a very practical way, when people think of materialism, and I think this is quite correct, is that when you call somebody materialistic, this is usually somebody, you're not thinking of someone who's philosophically materialistic so
right.
much. He doesn't know all that stuff, most people, but he has an inordinate desire for things, the
okay.
acquisition of things. There's no reality in the spiritual world, then the only thing that you can desire are material things.
Obviously, there's no reason to go to Mass on Sunday and make that sacrifice, which is the general theme we're talking about, keep holy the Lord's Day, if there isn't anything besides material.
That's correct.
My car, my house, my new Rolex watch. So I'd want to spend all my time in getting material things.
Sure.
Okay. How about... you want to say a thing about that, or you go on to relativism? Because they're all kind of cousins,
sure.
aren't they?
They're all related, of course. Well, we said earlier when we were talking about skepticism that this leads to relativism. And relativism is the view that truth is relative and may vary from individual to individual, from group to group, from time to time. There's no objective standard. An example of cultural relativism, which claims that different cultures have different but perfectly legitimate and equal valid standards of truth and value. It's often put together with the word subjectivism. A lot of times you'll hear subjectivism and relativism used together. For example, by subjectivism, I mean an ideology or philosophy that holds that only valid standard of judgment is that of the individual. For example, ethical subjectivism holds that individual conscience is the only appropriate standard for moral judgment.
All right, I think abortion is okay,
yes.
So it's okay.
That's it.
I think abortion is not okay, so for me, subjectively, the subject, it's not okay.
Yes.
But there isn't any really right or wrong outside of what the individual thinks.
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Pope Benedict the 16th, our present pope, he believes that our biggest enemy is moral relativism.
Wow, that's a big statement.
He's written on that. In fact, it's some one of the speeches that he gave right before he was elected pope was on that subject of moral relativism.
And is that where he used the phrase, the dictatorship of relativism?
Yes, that's where he used that phrase. But this is the moral relativism is the belief that something is right or wrong depending upon the time and the place, the circumstance, the situation, relevance, consequence, context. There are philosophies that people have spun out called contextualism or consequentialism or situation ethics or circumstantialism.
Stop there just a moment because that was really popular for a while in the church. A situation ethics, right or wrong. I remember a specific example that a guy was giving. He said, now, adultery is wrong for some people, but it's not wrong for other people. Here's the example he gave. He said, this person was trying to help another person with their bad self-image. And he thought the way to help the person with their bad self-image was to have sexual relations with them, even though he was married and the other person, he wasn't married to this person. And the guy who was giving this speech was actually defending that and saying he was performing a genuine act of selflessness towards the other person. He was really concerned about helping the other person. And that's very subtle. And I remember I was sitting in the lecture next to a Lutheran minister, and I said, what do you think about that? He says, I think it's crazy.
This was all done for the sake of love.
Right.
I did a lot of reading on that situation ethics back a number of years ago. The biggest name in that area was Joseph Fletcher.
Okay.
Man with the name of, I'm sure you came across
I forgot his name, but that's it.
And probably the biggest defender of the traditional view was a Protestant, I believe he was a minister, Paul Ramsey.
Okay.
But those were the two big names. But you see, there's certain Catholics that get all involved with that. There was Richard McCormick.
Yeah.
So he was basically took the relativist view. Bernard Haring.
Haring, I think, that German theologian.
Yes. There was Charles Kieran in this country, of course, and a number of others that really went into that relativism and that situation ethics and all. If it's done as something is done for the sake of love, because obviously it depends on how you define love.
Sure.
If it's something contrary to God, we Catholics, Christians, a true Christian, can't believe that that's a loving act.
We say it can't be a
loving
act.
That's right. It's the opposite of a loving act, actually.
But it's very subtle, Ron.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I can see the attraction for that.
Well, it justifies all of your, it satisfies, it plays to our concupiscence, our desire to
our
sin.
Lower nature.
Yeah, our lower nature.
What does Paul call it? The flesh.
Yes, it justifies it
in
our mind.
Okay, well, anything else to say about relativism? I think you've said pretty much when you said that our Holy Father Pope Benedict XVI has defined that as, one of the greatest currents of thought that we have to be prepared against and defend ourselves against. It's kind of a pollution of our minds.
Yes.
All right, anything to say about hedonism?
Probably hedonism is perhaps one of the most important of all of them. Next to materialism. If I had to pick only two, I would pick materialism and hedonism.
All right.
Of the five or six we've talked about. And this is an ethical system that holds that feelings of pleasure or happiness are the highest and final aim of conduct. so that actions increasing the sum of pleasure are thereby right, and those increasing pain are thereby wrong. Practically speaking, again, that's more of the philosophical way of looking at it. Practically speaking, hedonism is an excessive desire for pleasure. It's an excessive desire to have fun.
Okay, I remember studying the old Roman philosophers in seminary, and I forget who said it, but the Epicureans, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That pleasure is the purpose of life, and so let's have as good a time as we can, regardless of how it might be self-destructive to ourselves or others.
Yeah, and by practically speaking, we're talking about hedonism, we're talking about gluttony, we're talking about lust, we're talking about greed, we're talking about basically the capital sins, at least some of the capital sins anyway. Drinking too much, eating too much, becoming sexually addicted, all kinds of things of that sort, or
laziness.
Certainly sloth, particularly spiritual laziness, is the worst, one of the worst sins of all.
Okay.
Of course, pride's always the worst, but...
What is?
Pride.
Oh, okay. And we'll do a whole series on that sometime.
Yes, I can,
I'm still struggling with that. Okay, well, let's... how do you think these things we talked about, hedonism, relativism, materialism, rationalism, and skepticism, and what did you say you thought the two biggest were, hedonism and relativism?
Materialism and hedonism, yeah. Hedonism and... I think hedonism and materialism, and you really get
okay.
down to it.
How do you think these have contributed to our loss of faith as Catholics in the United States?
Well, I think that to the extent that our lives are dominated by these isms, and I say especially materialism and hedonism, we're not Christ-like. We're not like Jesus. We are not leading our lives in accordance with God's will. We're not obeying his commandments as we should. No matter how much we might know about Jesus, and in today's world, chances are many of us don't know very much. Most of us don't know him personally, though. You can know a lot about him, but you don't know him personally very well.
Is it true to say I can't know Jesus personally without some kind of prayer?
Oh, you definitely have to have prayer, because that's communication. That's talking to God, really, as I think it was St. Teresa of Lisieux referred to. But I think that that our belief in God and his promises can be strong only to the extent our lives are configured to Jesus's, and only to the extent we achieve being images of God, the image he created us to be, will our faith be strong. And so all of these isms militate against us being like Jesus.
Ron, I see these grains in the hourglass of time running out on us, so I think we're going to have to conclude there, and we'll take up on the next session, third session, where we left off today, about talking about how keeping holy the Lord's Day, that the Lord's Day can keep us holy, and some of the major influences that keep us from doing that. So for now, may God bless you always and in always.